Hello, and thanks for joining us for another value-packed Tenant Cloud podcast. My name is Chris Flugie, and I'm your host in today's Tenant Cloud podcast, where we're going to talk about five ways that you can increase your revenue from your rentals, even in an economy that is not friendly towards rentals, and ways that you can protect your rental from becoming empty or occupied by a non-paying tenant. And as we all know, we are currently in a scenario where that is the case with millions of landlords across the United States. And so this podcast is going to be helpful, I think, in providing you with some information that you can use to avoid yourself being in that situation. So without further ado, we'll jump right in. And the first thing that I wanted to talk about is you want to verify all of your applicants' employment details. In today's economy, you have a lot of scenarios that I see all the time with property managers reporting that applicants are providing false W-2s, false employment records, false pay stubs, even false letters from employers to try to get into a rental that they cannot otherwise afford. And so it's important that you properly verify all of the applicant's employment details. There's actually quite a few websites out there that people can go on and generate fake pay stubs and fake letters to fake employment at any place that they want, including completely made up businesses. And so if you've never heard of that, that is a thing. It's actually a huge problem. And it's definitely something that you need to keep an eye out for. So the way that you do that, the way that you verify all of your applicants' employment details is you need to make sure that you are looking through the information provided on the pay stubs or the letter. And the first sign that something is wrong is when the math doesn't add up. 9 times out of 10, the numbers on fake pay stubs just don't make sense. At first glance, you might be like, okay, I see. You're making $4,000 a month or whatever. But once you actually start looking at the numbers and the taxes being taken out and the frequency of the pay rate, sometimes even the frequency of the pay rate doesn't add up to the total amount that they've earned year to date based on the day that they say that they started that job. And so there's ways that you can pick up on red flags when you're being provided with false employment documentation. And so you want to make sure that you're actually looking at the numbers and not just taking a number off the page and saying, okay, they're good, we can approve this applicant based on this information. The second thing that you can do is you can actually verify with the employer that the individual is employed, that they are employed in the title that they indicated that they currently operate in, the role they operate in, and that the income on the verification form or the pay stubs or whatever is accurate as well. And so whether you do that through email or whether you do it through a phone call or fax, whatever it is that you end up doing it, or if you do it through some type of software, whatever way you verify, it's just important that you do verify the employer's information and contact them. Now, even if you don't do that on a regular basis, you should still do it. You should at least just call the number just to make sure that the number on the form is the actual business that the person indicated it is for. Because a lot of times that's the other thing, is the information provided on these fake employment documents is often for a fictitious business. And so when you actually call the phone number or send an email, then a lot of times that information comes back that this isn't that business. We don't even operate under that name. And so obviously that's an immediate red flag as well. So just pay attention to employment information that is being provided by potential applicants so that you are able to confirm the employment details for that person. The second way that you can increase your revenue for your rental and ensure that you do not have somebody in the rental who is a non-paying tenant when you are searching for a new tenant is to raise your income requirements if you can, though. You cannot do it all the time because some areas, some cities even have restrictions and ordinances in place where you cannot require an excessive amount of income compared to the rent of your property. So you do want to make sure that this is something that you check with your state and local laws just to make sure that you're not in violation of something. But in most cases, it's not uncommon for a lot of rental properties to require at least 2.5 times more income than the amount of the rent. That's entirely normal. Some landlords find it better to go above and beyond that rental requirement for income and go to 3, 4, and sometimes even 5 times the amount of the monthly rent. So, for instance, if rent is $1,000 a month, instead of having to earn $2,500 a month, well, now you have to show that you earned $3,000 or $3,500 or $4,000, whatever it may be. And again, this not only will that not be legal in some areas, but it also may not be feasible in some areas just because of the demographic that is renting in your area, or the just the community that your rental property is in general. Maybe you just don't have people living in that area that earn that kind of money. And so that may not always be possible, but it's definitely something to take a look at with your rental and with your area to see if it is possible for you to increase your income requirements to make sure that the person that you are approving for your rental has the ability to afford it well above and beyond what whatever any other obligations, financial obligations they have are. And so again, just something to look at with your rental property and see if that's something that you are able to do for your rental. Number three is to be lenient and not completely shut your property out from tenants who might have pets. Now, this is something that I actually wrote about pretty extensively and provided a lot of data on in a blog that I wrote about a little over a year ago. And you can find it on the tenantcloud.com/blog. And the title, if you want to search for it, is "Your Tenant is Hiding This From You and It is Costing You Thousands." And it has to do with pets. And you might be interested to know that in 2014, Apartments.com did a survey and found that only 43% of renters who were surveyed said they owned a pet. But just a few years later in 2017, and this is a trend that continues to take place, the number of renters surveyed by Apartments.com said that 72% of them now had pets. And that is insane. That is a huge number of renters who have pets. And so for any landlord to not allow pets in their rental property is missing out on a significant amount of money. And the kicker, because you're not charging a pet deposit because you don't allow pets, and because you're not charging pet rent because you don't allow pets, the fact is, another survey by Firepaw Inc. did a nationwide research study, found that over 20% of tenants reported that they had pets in the rental property illegally because they had a pet in a property that was owned by a landlord who didn't allow pets, but they still had a pet in the rental property. So not only do your tenants most likely, even if you don't allow pets in your property, not only do they most likely still have pets in your rental property, but you're also not collecting and you're not benefiting from that. And so you're not getting the pet deposit. You're not getting any pet rent. And that number just continues to grow every year. It's been a trend for decades now, and it's just really skyrocketed, especially with all of the campaigns for adopting pets and from shelters and to really focus on reducing the amount of pets that are in that are ending up basically being euthanized. And so every generation, it's just become a more serious thing, and more people really become dedicated to that. And so people have just exploded. The number of people who have pets has just simply exploded over the past decade, especially. So definitely something that you should review with your rental. We have also written other blog articles on tenantcloud.com that go into the details about how the facts simply don't line up with a lot of content out there that talks about all the damages and how landlords end up losing money in the long run and so on and so forth. It's simply not true. if you charge pet deposits, you charge pet rent, you actually 99% of the time, statistics have shown, and we cite a lot of information in our articles, you always come out on top in your rental by allowing pets, regardless of whether the pet causes any damages and so on and so forth. So there are some extreme cases that you will hear about and you read about occasionally, but those are very rare circumstances, and it's not the norm when it comes to people with pets. And so definitely something you should consider, and it definitely something to look into as far as, should you charge pet rent? There's arguments out there not to charge pet rent, but just collect a pet deposit that's sufficient to cover damages. Other landlords will tell you, no, you should charge pet rent. And at the end of the day, it's just, it's important that you review whether or not you should have pets in your property, because you are very likely losing out on money, and your tenants probably already have pets, even if you told them they can't have pets in the rental to begin with. So moving along, we will go to the next point, which is number four. You want to advertise your rental property and try to get in tenants when you can through word of mouth advertising. And so that is through referrals from your existing tenants. That is through maybe coworkers, through friends, through family, whoever it may be. Now, this is not something that you just, somebody refers you and you automatically approve them because they know so and so. You still go through the regular application process. You still go through the approval process. You still go through the verification process. Nothing changes as far as the application and approval process goes, but you tend to find better qualified applicants when you go through your existing networks, and that includes existing tenants. If you have great tenants, or you have a tenant who pays rent on time, and let's say you have a duplex and you've rented out one side and that person has been a tenant for a long time, they're a great tenant, what better way than for them to be able to essentially refer who their neighbor is going to be, and that person is typically going to be somebody who is similar to the person in the other side of the rental, who is a qualified renter, who they know, and they're going to get along already because they're already friends. They already have a relationship. You won't have any of that strife between tenants. There's just all kinds of benefits that come into it. Now, you can't violate any fair housing laws. You can't do anything illegal when it comes to this. You still have to go through the regular application and screening processes and approval processes as required by federal, state, and local laws and ordinances. But it is a good approach to get people to apply through your existing network when you can, especially from existing tenants who are good tenants in your rental property. I've taken that approach many times over the years, and I always got well-qualified tenants directly through a referral program. And so you can incentivize your existing tenants to do this as well by offering something, usually a financial incentive, like $100 off the new person's first month of rent and $100 off of the person who referred them, or whatever it is, whatever you think is a good and attractive incentive to your tenant to refer people to you, to your rental property, you would want to look at taking that approach. Moving on to the final item is you want to make sure that you are not being restrictive when it comes to the ability to have more tenants in your rental property, as long as it's within the state guidelines where your rental is located at. So for instance, if your state law allows you to have two adults and one child under the age of 10, let's just say, but your restrictions, your occupancy restrictions in your rental property is, well, only one adult because it's a small rental, it's 700 square feet or whatever it is. You may want to consider changing that occupancy requirement to meet the state occupancy limits. You can't exceed state occupancy limits, but you can meet the state occupancy limits if you're currently more restrictive than what those occupancy limits are. And the reason for that is you can often get, if you have two people in a rental versus one, then a lot of times both of those individuals have income coming in, and it's, the financial situation is quite a bit more stable than if you just had one tenant with one source of income in your rental property. And also a lot of times, if you are able to meet your state requirements for occupancy limits, let's say it is, you increase it to 2 adults and a child under the age of 10 or whatever the rule is in your area, then you also open the door for a lot of more qualified applicants. You increase the pool of availability of qualified tenants who could potentially apply to your rental property. Whereas that 100, 200 people or families couldn't apply for your rental property previously, well, now they can. Because before it was just one person in the rental because it's a 700 square foot apartment and nobody else is allowed. But now it's 2 people plus a child or whoever under the age of whatever the age is. And in some areas, this law is a child under the age of 2 because they're considered a baby. And so it might be 1 adult and 1 baby or whatever the situation is in your area. Again, you can't violate any fair housing laws or any of that stuff, but there are occupancy situations where landlords have much stricter occupancy limits than what their state or their city actually allows. And so it's something that you do want to look into and make sure that you're not being more restrictive than what you're actually allowed to go up to. In fact, in Houston, when I first met my wife years ago, we were restricted from renting a one-bedroom apartment because at the time we had a young child who had just gone over the age of 2, and we were not allowed to apply for this one-bedroom apartment, which was in a pretty good area, and we both had really good income, and we both had fantastic rental history. We've never been late or any of that stuff, and we were not allowed to apply for the rental because our child was over the age of 2. Now, it wasn't against the city's ordinance. We were still, that was allowed under the city ordinance, but it was the apartment community's policy that was their occupancy limit. It was 2 adults to a 1-bedroom, and if your child was over the age of 2, you had to get a 2-bedroom apartment. And so they missed out on great tenants because of that occupancy limit that was just theirs, not the actual city's occupancy limit where we were trying to rent. And so just something to keep in mind and to take into consideration, especially in a time where you're trying to get the best qualified tenants with the most secure financial situation and to ensure that you have that rental revenue coming into your rental property consistently and have a lower risk of losing that tenant in the long run. So I hope that you've found the information that has been discussed in this podcast helpful. If you have, please feel free to share it with any friends, family, coworkers, associates, whoever. And we'd love to get this information to as many people as possible. Also, feel free to rate this podcast anywhere that you are listening to it. We always love to hear your feedback on the podcast and to continue to provide quality information to you. Again, thanks for tuning in and spending this time with us. We'll look forward to talking with you next time.